From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And this morning we're going to explore the cloud forests of Costa Rica with twins Kyle and Trevor Ritland. They are the authors of a book being released next week. It's titled The Golden Toad, An Ecological Mystery and the Search for a Lost Species. They're sharing how they turned their father's bedtime stories into an extensive investigation into Costa Rica's rarely seen golden toad after it was presumed extinct. The twins dive into a deeper story about ecological grief, overlooked local wisdom, and the possibility that the golden toad may still reside within the cloud forest.
That's right. Then renowned writer and journalist John Valiant joins the show to talk about his book, Fire Weather, A True Story from a Hotter World. A 2023 National Book Award finalist, Valiant describes the 2016 Fort McMurray wildfire in Alberta, Canada. He also describes the science of fire and forest health, the fascinating relationships between humans and fire, and the future of fire-related disasters. Environmental awareness and education, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
And we're excited this morning to first introduce you to twins, Kyle and Trevor Ritland. They are environmental writers, and they also just penned a book called The Golden Toad, An Ecological Mystery and the Search for a Lost Species. Kyle and Trevor, thanks for joining us. It's good to have you on the show, and we have a lot of questions between the two of us, so we want to dive right in. I think the way to start, though, is it's really fascinating how you two came about researching this or wanting to investigate this. And you said that it came from some childhood stories that your father had told you. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Both of our parents were biologists. We grew up in the Blue Ridge Mountains of the Southeast, and so they were really our introduction to the natural world. We were always running around outside, chasing butterflies, looking for salamanders in waterfall crevices, you know, always interested in, I was always interested more in birds growing up. Trevor was really a frog guy, but yeah, our father would sit us down sometimes in front of his old slide projector and tell us stories about nature and the world and all these animals, and the golden toad was one of those. And it really struck Trevor, I think, more than me, because he was the one who kind of brought this story back to me later on in our life.
Yeah, our dad was a biology teacher at a college in the town where we grew up in for years and years. And I think he liked that because he got to tell stories all day, every day. And even when, you know, our mom had heard all the stories before, he got a new group of students to tell stories to every year. And so he had a lot of cool stories about a lot of cool different species. And one of those was the golden toad. He had friends who he had been in grad school with when he was doing butterfly research, who were working in Costa Rica doing research there, and our parents visited them and heard the story of this really unique toad that was known only to this one little Costa Rican town. And by the time he told that story to us, the golden toad had disappeared. Mm. And so it was this kind of weird introduction to a species that was already gone, almost like a ghost story more than a, you know, biology story. And the way he told that story and the way he kind of used it as a symbol of loss and extinction and how fragile endangered species are and ecosystems are really stuck with us. And it wasn't until years later where kind of by accident, I found myself living in Monteverde in the town that this golden toad had once called home that I started to really try to learn more about the species. And as I learned more and talked to more local people, it kind of became clear that the story was not as simple as I had originally thought.
Yeah. Well, first, as a child of a professor, I totally relate to the storytelling and so my dad liked to exaggerate too. So kept everyone on the edge of their
seats.
That's
what makes a good story.
That's what makes a good story. So I can relate to that childhood, and you're learning about this place and then you end up there. Trevor, can you describe the ecology of this place and what's so fascinating or unique about it?
Oh, for sure. Monteverde, Costa Rica is one of the most interesting places I've ever been. It's huge amount of biodiversity. It's this cloud forest ecosystem at like 1,500 meters above sea level in Costa Rica on sort of the continental divide of the mountain range. And so it's really misty, kind of dense rainforest mist coming up and over from the Atlantic slope on the Continental Divide. It, at the top of the mountain, creates this really unique ecosystem that they call the Elfin Forest. So twisted trees that are all bent by the wind, mossy, dripping water, really high mist and cloud inputs. So a really kind of ethereal ecological ecosystem that makes for not only a high amount of biodiversity, but a really high amount of specialized species and endemic species, species found only in that one place. So the golden toad is a great example of that. There's also a ton of orchids that are endemic to Monteverde. Wow. Aside from the ecological factors that make it interesting, there's also some cultural factors that make it really interesting. So this is a community that was originally settled by Costa Rican farmers, homesteaders, but also by United States Quakers who were fleeing the Korean draft and looking for a new place to live where they weren't going to have to be drafted into a war. And they picked Costa Rica and they kind of carved a living out of this cloud forest ecosystem, working with local people to learn about the mysteries of volcanic soils and how to do farming in that area. And then eventually, because of the high biodiversity and the access that, you know, an English-speaking local culture brought, biologists came in the 60s, 70s, 80s and started to study kind of the world-class biodiversity of Monteverde. And it wasn't long before one of those local people led a biologist up to this ridgeline and showed them this really unique species, the golden toad.
So you described your investigations into the golden toad's disappearance as putting a puzzle together and collecting the pieces. What were these pieces you collected to create a better picture of what happened in the forest and subsequently to the golden toad?
Yeah, I'd say there's two pieces to that. One is the local stories and one is sort of the mystery of what happened to the species. I'll let Kyle speak to the mystery of what happened to the species, but the local perspective is one thing that we really wanted to make sure was included. As these stories get told, they get simplified, right? And so by the time the golden toad story reaches a college textbook or me, it's been simplified. And a lot of the intricacies and subtleties have been lost. And so there's a lot to the story that we started to discover as we were there talking to the local people, at first kind of by accident and then more and more deliberately. And so from the first people to see the species, trying to figure out who those people were and what their stories were, what their relationship with this species was before United States biologists came in and came to study it. But then also the relationship of the town with it, what it meant to the town and what its disappearance meant to the town. And then also the kind of specifics around the last sighting of the species. And so that last sighting of the golden toad is widely reported as a biologist from the United States who saw it in 1989. But that story is a little bit more complex. So it's actually a biologist graduate student who took a photo of it in this particular place. But then there's this other guy, local naturalist who used to be a farmer and decided he wanted to start conserving the forest instead, who saw golden toads a little bit later. And that was one piece of the puzzle that we really wanted to pursue. And even if just for our own curiosity, start to answer some questions around, you know, how was the species discovered? Yeah. What was the last sighting? What were the circumstances of its both appearance and disappearance? And then a whole other kind of box of puzzle pieces around what happened to the golden toad and what can we attribute its disappearance to?
There's definitely a murder mystery aspect to this story where the golden toad was ubiquitous and seen in huge numbers and really the icon of Monteverde for many years. And then it essentially vanished. And around 1989, there started to be these other noticings of other amphibians disappearing in large numbers. And the golden toad's disappearance was recognized as the beginning of what we now recognize to be a global amphibian decline. And so part of the book is tracing that understanding and putting together the pieces of what it was causing those large numbers of amphibians all across the globe to disappear, in some cases, like the golden toad, without a trace. And while we now understand the role of the chytrid fungus to be a major player in that amphibian decline, the mystery of what happened to the golden toad is still very much, as I was writing this book, unsolved in a lot of ways, because there were no bodies that were found. Oh. It was not something that we could go and test for chytrid and see, was the killer here? Did it actually kill the golden toad? We look at the role of this fungal pathogen, chytrid, but also the role of climate. And basically, we approached it as this murder mystery. We might be able to place the killers on this mountaintop at this time. But the question is, did they in fact kill the golden toad? Can we know that? Can we prove it?
Right. That's what I was wondering. If you said there were no bodies, quote unquote, no carcasses of the toad to do an analysis on, a CSI analysis of. But we do know that chytrid fungus has been the suspect, the primary suspect of a number of amphibious deaths around the world. So it's definitely in the lineup. What other suspects might have been assisted in this toad's extinction, let's say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the golden toad was one of the first alarm bells of this global amphibian crisis. And so the people studying its decline didn't necessarily know at the beginning that it was a part of a larger puzzle. And so we can look at Monteverde as a community that's very vulnerable to small changes. The great thing about being a really high elevation cloud forest is that you have that huge amount of biodiversity, but it also means that really small changes in the ecosystem can affect that ecosystem in really big ways. And so everything from like UV radiation to drought and El Nino temperature shifts and moisture shifts were implicated by the first biologists who were studying the decline of not only the golden toad, but other amphibian species in Monteverde specifically. Just a huge number of frogs and toads disappeared around this time as well. And the two primary suspects that we zero in on would be that chytrid fungus, kind of a pandemic, and climate change. And for a long time, the biologists who were kind of championing those factors were at odds with each other, because there's a limited amount of funding, of public attention. And so that's one thing that we explore in the book, is almost the conflict between people in different camps kind of trying to get public awareness about these factors that are impacting amphibians and other ecological changes, but also the way that those two things work together. And that's what we try to do in the book, is present the reader with information and evidence, and hopefully they'll kind of draw their own conclusions and make their own decisions informed by that evidence about what they think kind of contributed to the decline of this species. And the case of the golden toad is so interesting because they were so adapted to their environment at the top of this mountain that while other species could adapt to those changes, chytrid fungus, climate change, changes in temperature and moisture, the golden toads really had nowhere left to go. They couldn't climb higher on that mountain. So it's a great example of a vulnerable community feeling the impacts of climate change and disease mechanics and other environmental factors before like the rest of us. And you can see the forest changing in Monteverde, drier and wetter at different times of year, more extremes. And so I think it's kind of a warning sign to us of things that may be coming our way or are already here. And that was the primary motivation between figuring out what happened to this species, but also the complex way that all those different factors kind of work together to create these changes.
Right.
Can we highlight the golden toad itself and what role it might have played in the ecosystem and how it got its name?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, this species is just super cool. And if you haven't seen a photo of it, I recommend Googling the golden toad, because it's just this bright orange toad that lived at the top of this mountain. The males were bright orange. The females were kind of spectacled black and red and yellow, totally different. And they would appear for the first rains every rainy season for like a couple weeks, come out, compete for the attention of the females. The males would like wrestle with each other to try to mate with the females. So there's like cool photos of toad balls, like males wrestling with each other and just getting all tangled up. And so they would appear, a couple weeks every year and then disappear again. And biologists suspect they were probably fossorial, living under the ground for most of the year. The amount of things that we know about the golden toad are kind of limited, because they were first described by science in 1964 by Jay Savage, a biologist from the United States who did a lot of work, conservation work and education work in Costa Rica. And as soon as he described this species, he called it Bufo Peregrinis, which is Greek. It means very bright. And so the golden toad is kind of a, you know, corruption of that very bright toad name that he originally gave the species. And locally, they just call it El Sapo Dorado, the golden toad, or El Dorado, which is a great, I love saying, we're going looking for El Dorado. Right. So that's super cool. And yeah, I mean, it was discovered in 64. And then by the end of the 1980s, it had pretty much disappeared. And so biologists were just getting interested in studying the species and seeing what they could learn about it, and then it vanished. And so for everything we know about the golden toad, there's so much that we don't know, which is one of the great excuses to go digging around through all the scientific literature and talk to all the local folks who maybe didn't publish their findings in scientific papers, but knew this species well because it was local, it was their toad.
It sounds like a toad that would be in the middle of a Gabriel Garcia Marquez book, you know, about magical realism, 100 Years of Solitude or something like that.
Exactly. You know, exactly.
Yeah, the
and that's, I mean, being in that ecosystem feels like magical
yes.
realism. We went up and kind of worked through the historic habitat of the golden toad, and it feels like you're kind of on this ridgeline between life and the afterlife. It's very ethereal and cool.
We're speaking with Kyle and Trevor Ritland. They are the authors of a book that's going to be released next week. It's titled The Golden Toad, An Ecological Mystery and the Search for a Lost Species. So we always like to think that, well, maybe it's still out there. You know, its numbers have dwindled down dramatically. Is there any evidence that the toad could be still around, or are you hearing stories that maybe you know, of sightings, etc.?
Yeah, Kyle and I like to use the term circumstantial evidence, both
yes.
related to the mystery of the toad's decline and the hope that it could still be out there, right? So same in the same way that we can't necessarily convict a killer
right.
in the golden toad's extinction, the evidence of it still being out there kind of makes sense contextually, right? And so in Costa Rica and elsewhere in Central America in the last decade or so, a lot of the species that we had declared extinct or assumed to be gone have started to reemerge in different places.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that specifically in Monteverde. There are frogs and toads that disappeared in the 1980s as part of the broader amphibian declines that are now reappearing in different places. Like, okay, they disappeared from the Pacific slope. Now they're back.
Hmm.
It's starting to give people hope that these species might be back. And actually, when we decided to go on a search for the golden toad, we partnered with an organization called Rewild, and they have a whole search for lost species campaign that just sends biologists and local people out there looking for species that we think might be coming back. And in the case of the golden toad specifically, what really compelled us to say, okay, we actually just have to sit down and write a book about this because we are too curious about this mystery, is this local story from this local guy in Monteverde. He's a former farmer. He's become a conservationist. He was one of the first people to devote his land to conservation in Monteverde for the Children's Eternal Rainforest. And he has a story about doing a plant survey out along the ridge line that the golden toads used to be on, but just farther out on that ridge, and seeing a whole bunch of male, female, and juvenile golden toads in 1991, which is 2 years after they were supposed to be extinct. And sure, there's lots of stories about people seeing extinct species, and sometimes you believe them and sometimes you don't. But in Monteverde, this person's word is pretty well respected. He knows the species really well. He knows the environment really well. And so that story was just compelling enough to get us to say, well, maybe we need to go back and actually look for this spot again, because it's a place that people don't generally travel, and nobody had really been back there to look for golden toads since he had seen them in that spot in close to 30 years. And when you get to this question of, is a species there? Is it not there? I think sometimes the hope can be more enticing than the certainty. And so even when there's no definitive evidence that this species is still out there, it's still nice for me to go to sleep at night with that hope and say maybe it's out there somewhere. And just because we haven't seen it doesn't necessarily mean there's not still hope for
yeah.
the species.
Right. Hope is important, I think, in anything that you're working on or looking towards, because what else is there then?
Well, it reminds me of this country's obsession with the ivory-billed woodpecker, right? It was such an iconic, regal bird, and you know, now it's quote-unquote gone, but of course, every month there's another sighting of it, you know, somewhere in the Southeast, people swear that it's still around because we don't want to lose it. We don't want to lose. Mm-hmm. No one grabbed the golden toad or, you know, had one in captivity or so during this time.
I definitely have a friend who said if golden toads are still out there, they're in a terrarium in a German basement somewhere, because there were, you know, collectors moving through Central America around this time who were snatching frogs. But if somebody has one, they certainly haven't announced it to the world yet. Yes. They tried captive breeding with this species, but it's one that just didn't take to it early on. And of course, looking back, we could say, oh, yeah, it would have been nice to try harder. But it just disappeared so quickly, you know.
So in looking at the Monteverde cloud forest today and its biodiversity, do you feel like we, again, have hope here? How much work do you think needs to be done at this time to help preserve a place like this?
Yeah, there's absolutely hope. I mean, one of the good things about this species disappearing is that in the wake of the golden toad's disappearance, we saw the beginning of a conservation ethic really take hold in Monteverde. It had been there before, but it really kind of kicked into high gear after the golden toad disappeared. And not long after that, we saw the founding of what's called the Children's Eternal Rainforest, which it's a really cool story. I could tell that story too. But basically, it started by a biologist who'd visited Monteverde giving a slideshow presentation to some school children in Sweden about this cool cloud forest. And here's what it contains, and here's all the biodiversity, and here's the species that are in trouble because of deforestation. And those Swedish school kids got together and raised a bunch of money. And that effect snowballed, and it led to what's now the largest private forest reserve in Costa Rica. And it protects the historic habitat of the golden toad. The Monteverde Cloud Forest Reserve protects another part of that habitat. And so you have these different reserves working together. And in accordance with local grassroots conservation efforts too, there's great reforestation efforts happening. There's an organization called Palo Vivo, which is like people who like to climb fig trees who are doing reforestation in Monteverde to make sure there's more trees to climb. And so even people who aren't necessarily in it for the frogs are working together to make sure that these species, if they do come back, have a place to come back to and protect those species that are still there.
Nice.
Well, we are speaking with twins, Kyle and Trevor Ritlin, who lived up for a while, maybe still in Monteverde, Costa Rica, and spent a lot of time there and took a look at the loss of the golden toad, and ergo wrote a book called The Golden Toad, An Ecological Mystery and the Search for a Lost Species. And it is released next week, is that correct?
That's right, June 17th, so 1 week from today. But you can pre-order it now if you're so inclined.
Where do people do that?
You can go to findthegoldentoad.com or kyleandtrevor.com. That's both of those are our websites, so you can find not only, you know, order the book there, but a lot of cool little photos and images and archival things that are included in the book if you want to sneak peek at some of the stuff that's going to be there.
And there's a documentary. Am I right?
That's right. So we have a documentary called El Dorado, The Search for the Golden Toad, and actually hoping to release part two of that documentary before too much longer here, that actually covers our return to the site of the golden toad's last appearance.
Kyle and Trevor Ritlin, thank you again so much for joining us this morning on this golden earth.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Nice talking to you.
I'm not sure. Okay, thank you so much, you guys. We appreciate you.
And joining us for the second part of the show is John Valiant. He's here to talk about his book, Fire Weather, A True Story from a Hotter World. And John's going to be in Park City to talk about his book and take your questions at the Park City Library in July. We'll get to those details a little later. But John, thank you so much for joining Claire and me on this green earth.
Hi there. So good to be with you.
Great to have you. The book is really interesting. It talks about, among other things, of course, the science of wildfires, the prevalence of more and more wildfires and intense wildfires. But its main protagonist, I guess we'll say, is the 2016 Fort McMurray wildfire that occurred in Alberta, Canada. Remind us about that fire and why it was so damaging and unique.
Well, May 3rd, 2016, kind of marked a turning point, I think, in our relationship to what I call 21st century fire. And we've seen an awful lot of it in the past decade. But May 3rd, 2016 was when a wildfire about 6 miles wide and 300 feet tall swept into Fort McMurray, Alberta. Fort McMurray, Alberta is about 800 miles north of you, north of Salt Lake City, deep in the boreal forest on a latitude with southern Alaska. It's a very isolated place, but it's the capital, it's the petroleum hub of Canada. And it's the source of about 4 million barrels a day of petroleum products that are pipelined out of that region and over the border into American refineries. So the idea of what is effectively the Houston of Canada being overrun by fire and triggering the largest, most rapid evacuation due to fire in modern times was a signal event. And because it happened in Canada, it didn't get Americans' attention the way the LA fires did, the way the Paradise fire did, the way the Lahaina fires did. But all those fires were basically follow-ups to what happened in Fort McMurray, where the temperatures inside the city were exceeding 900 degrees Fahrenheit, and houses, $500,000 two-story modern North American houses were burning to the ground, to the basement, in 5 minutes flat.
Wow. And just as an aside, this oil-producing region is, the oil comes in the form of bitumen, which is actually, if I understand it correctly, is a surface excavated process. It's not like putting a pipe down, a straw down into the ground and pulling oil out. We're used to. This is a really, really dirty form of oil. Do I got that right?
You sure did. It's the dirtiest, most inefficient, most environmentally and financially costly way to recover hydrocarbons ever devised. Bitumen is basically a driveway sealer, but in the case of Alberta, it's soaked in sand. So they mine it like coal. And then they heat it up with billions of cubic feet of natural gas per day,
right,
to melt this stuff into something that will move through a pipeline. And then they load it up with petroleum distillates that enable it to stay liquid and can be transported into specially designed refineries on the U.S. border that can handle this incredibly dirty fuel. It's basically liquid tar.
Right.
Most oil, as we know, floats. This is the only petroleum product that sinks in water.
Wow. And that's a good point. It actually requires fossil fuels in the form of natural gas to produce this fossil fuel, which then needs more fossil fuels to keep it liquid enough and warm enough so that it can be pumped.
Exactly. And then it needs more fossil fuels to refine it a second time into petroleum products that our engines and power plants can recognize.
Okay.
And the only reason they can do it is because it's sold at a tremendous discount and they can do it in massive quantities relatively cheaply. But once oil starts to drop below $55, $50 a barrel, and it's not far from there right now, it starts to become a loser.
Okay.
And so most of the year, it used to be, there was a global involvement in this industry 15 years ago, and they fled. The Norwegians and the Chinese have hung in there, but most other European and Western companies have abandoned it, partly because it has such a bad look environmentally, but also because it's a really inefficient fuel and clearly out of step with the needs of the current era.
Got it.
So when you're investigating this fire and trying to understand it and what happened, and you come back to this understanding first of our relationship as humans to fire and how we're intrinsically linked to it, can you walk us through that evolution of humans and fire and why that makes such a big difference as you explore it and investigate it?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Claire. That really was a big digression for me, but ended up being central to the story because I started thinking about all the stuff we burn. And I started looking around my house and realizing everything in my home is at some point mediated through fire's energy. You know, if it's a metal, it has to be heated up and melted into a form that I can use. So many of the products we have, our running shoes, our Lululemon joggers, our mattresses are made from petroleum distillates, our garbage cans. I mean, everything in our modern world is in some way mediated through the energy or the products of fossil fuels. And so I started looking at the history of that burning and our relationship to fire. And fire, as I kind of eventually discovered, besides, you know, our tremendous brains and our ability to speak and our opposable thumbs and our ability to function, operate communally, the other superpower we have is our ability to manipulate fire. And so from the very beginning, when we started just taking burning sticks out of wildfires and waving them around and realizing we can light up the darkness and scare away predators and keep ourselves warm and cook our food, we have stayed really close to fire. And to the point that now, if we were to count the number of fires humans make every day around the world, everything from burning off stubble in an agricultural field to a biomass burner to internal combustion engines, we ignite trillions of fires every day. And I just imagined for a moment, what if we could see all the fires humans make? And it would be like this flickering galaxy of flame on planet Earth. And if we were Martians looking down at the planet at nighttime, looking at human activities, there would be fires all around us, in our car engines, in our homes, at our dinner tables, in our stoves, in our hot water heaters. And if you could see them all, it would be this flickering galaxy, and you, and an alien might think, wow, that is one dedicated fire cult down there. They are really, really like fire, and everything they do involves burning. And so that was interesting to realize how closely we are allied to it. And then I started thinking that human beings and fire have a lot in common. We're both energy consuming, gas generating, heat generators. And so we off-gas CO2, fires do too. We generate heat, so do fires. We're constantly looking for more fuel, whether it's money to pay our bills and buy our food, or food that we're actually going to eat. And that's why fire moves around too. It's looking for more food. So I realized, you know, we're almost allies. We have a lot in common, and we kind of energize each other. We're a little bit like drinking buddies who kind of encourage each other to do more and more wild and outlandish things.
Well, it's interesting you say that. It feels like almost there's also this battle of control between humans trying to control fire. And you've described it also as a predator, so you're giving it these very human characterizations, but I think it helps people understand our relationship with it and what it means to the world and our planet and how we'll always have a relationship with it.
Oh, it's inevitable. And fire is part of our world the same way any other form of weather is. Rain and storms and lightning, you know, mm-hmm. They're just part of the package if you live on planet Earth. And I think it's fair to call fire a hunter. Obviously, it doesn't have the same kind of intellectual intention that we do or that our tiger does, but it's got a kind of bottomless appetite. And, you know, if you set fire to the mattress, the fire is not going to be content with the mattress. It's going to burn the bedspread. Mm. It's going to try to catch onto the curtains. It'll burn the house down if it can, and it'll go to the neighbor's house if at all possible. And that's what we're seeing now, is just the ferocity and the rapacity of these fires. And right now, Canada is burning so badly and so aggressively that I'm actually speaking to you from France across the Atlantic Ocean. And when I look up at the sky, there is haze from Canadian wildfires all over France, all over Western Europe right now. And and what we're seeing is a hotter world, a drier world, and these are conditions that allow fire to behave with more aggression and to basically indulge a bigger appetite. And it's quite dangerous, not just for our lungs, but for our communities. And there are 30,000 Canadians on the road now, evacuated because of the threat of wildfire in their communities.
That's right. I just wanted to add to that what you said, that right now, or as of Sunday, there are 227 active wildfires across Canada, including about 20 now in Ontario, which is a very heavily, relatively speaking, a more populated province in Canada. 7.5 million acres of forests have been burned, which is roughly 12,000 square miles, or in Utah is like 1/7 of Utah has burned.
To date.
Yeah, exactly. If you just join us, we're speaking with John Valiant, author of the book Fire Weather, A True Story from a Hotter World. And it was a 2023 National Book Award finalist. So, John, what are the primary sources of these fires, say, up in Canada? What's going on there? And is that increasing?
Well, there's a pretty common mix, you know, and this is similar for Alaska too. Lightning is a major cause of fires in remote areas, mm-hmm. and a lot of northern Canada is remote. And as the climate warms, with every degree of warming, you get about, I think, 7 or 12% more lightning. And so we're getting storms now in Alaska and across the north, where you will have thousands of lightning strikes in a single storm. And not all of them ignite a wildfire, but you don't need that many to ignite in order to make a potentially terrible fire. So So that's a major contributor. But around settled areas, this is, you know, going back to, you know, what we were speaking about earlier, fire follows us everywhere we go. And so it could be a campfire that wasn't properly doused. It could be a hot muffler on an ATV.
Right.
It could be sparks from a chain that's dragging behind your truck.
Yeah.
It could be any number of things that could start a fire. And it might even just be a smolder. And it might just smolder for a week, and then you get a particularly hot day or a stiff wind, and that fire that looked like it was nothing, that no one could even see a week ago, is now raging out of control. And then, you know, there's a lot of concern about arson. And, you know, arson is a factor, but it's not what makes fires terrible. What makes fires terrible are elevated temperatures and reduced humidities. And that's the real recipe for disaster. And as you raise the temperature of the earth, you heat up the forest floor, you heat up all the fuels in the forest, and that also lowers their humidity. And so they become drier and easier to burn. And you know all about that in around Salt Lake City, where if you go camping in the woods there, it's pretty easy to start a fire because the wood is so dry and it gets so hot so fast.
Well, just to kind of supplement your examples there, the largest fire we had here in recent years was 600 acres or so, relatively small, but very close to Park City, occurred when a car coming up Parley's Canyon was having difficulty making its way up the canyon, pulled over, and the catalytic converter was hot enough that the car pulled over in the grass, dried grass, high winds, high fire risk day. The fire started, the people in the car, in a minute or two, the fire became out of control. They couldn't put it out. Boom, 600 acres burned during the course of the next 24 to 36 hours. So, like you say, it takes one bolt of lightning, it takes one hot catalytic converter, it takes one chain dragging behind a car that sets sparks. These days, there's a lot of more fire danger out here. And of course, here out here west in our storms, a lot of our thunderstorms are dry, right? So to speak, they're not the classic southeast U.S. Eastern thunderstorms that have a lot of rain with them. So we have a lot of dry storms that make the lightning even more risky. I just wanted to throw that in there.
Yeah, and also out west, trains start a lot. Because their wheels throw sparks all the time. And if you have the right conditions, we've had some terrible fires in Canada started by trains. And, you know, these are just human beings doing their job.
Right.
You know, living their normal lives, being conscientious, you know, driving the car safely, pulling over when it gets too hot, that's a sensible thing to do. But we're not always able to factor in the fact that, wow, the car is now so hot that it's going to light up the surroundings. And because it's a little bit hotter and a little bit drier, that fire is going to be out of control more quickly. And that's what we're finding more and more often. And, you know, L.A. was a really graphic example of that, where you had 80-mile-an-hour winds, right, and essentially a kind of a blast furnace effect in these neighborhoods. And there's really nothing. Those are unfightable fires. There's nothing a firefighter can do except try to get their crew out of there safely, along with the citizenry.
Last couple minutes. How does the Fort McMurray fire end? How long did it burn? And when did it finally go out?
Well, I must have set a record, I think, for the time burning within city limits. It burned for about a week.
Hmm.
And the rain never came, the heat never let up, and neighborhood after neighborhood was leveled. And finally they got a grip on it, but it kept burning through the forest. It kept moving eastward. It went all the, you know, Alberta's a huge province. It's right, bigger than Texas. Moved out of Alberta into Saskatchewan, another huge province. It then burned through the summer and fall, went underground into the root system during the winter, came up again in the spring, and was not declared fully out until August of 2017, which was 15 months later.
Wow. Wow. So eventually, you know, winter, the seasons play a role in at least driving that fire underground, not humans per se.
And what they're just discovered, Mike Flanagan, a very well-respected fire scientist from Western Canada, said, who's been studying wildfire since the 1970s. So that's, you know, it was another world then, you know, environmentally. But he said for the first time he's seen wildfires go subterranean 2 years running. In other words, the same fire burning through the summer, going underground in the winter and popping up again the next summer, and then going underground and popping up again the next spring. In other words, this is a continuous fire, basically burning since the terrible fire season of 2023, which was the worst fire season in Canadian history. And that's what smoked out a lot of the eastern states and Europe too. And it looks like we are setting up for a similar fire season this year, unfortunately.
So in your book, Fire Weather, A True Story from a Hotter World, you take readers through kind of the history about fire, and then you go into this particular fire in Canada, and then maybe a look into what might lie ahead for us. Can you share a little bit about your thoughts on the future or where we're at now and that what that's leading us toward and maybe how to mitigate it?
Yeah, I wrote this. So this all happened in 2016, 10 years ago. And think of the fires that we can reel off by name now that have killed Americans, that have killed people in Spain, in Portugal, in Australia, in Greece, and in Canada. Most of those fires had not ignited in 2016. And so when I saw Fort McMurray burn the way it did, I thought, my goodness, you know, we're entering a new fire regime. And these terrible fires that have followed since then, you know, LA being the most recent and most notorious, but one of many at this point since 2016, I just thought I wanted to sound an alarm and also help people understand the role that the petroleum industry plays, not only in causing this, but in prolonging it by delaying climate action. And that's really it. We're in a very cynical situation right now. And, you know, in the United States, we're now in a full state of climate denial. Alberta is too, but many other nations, fortunately, are being honest about the role petroleum plays in climate change and are working very, very hard to transition into renewable energy. China, of course, is leading the charge by leaps and bounds. But other nations and states too are making really meaningful, needle-moving progress on moving away from fossil fuels, which generate CO2 and methane that makes our climate hotter and more flammable, and moving into wind, solar, tidal, and geothermal, and hydropower, and that's that's our pathway out. That and just reducing the amount of energy we use, and AI is pushing us in the wrong direction as far as that goes. So we're in a very tense moment right now. This generation will be the defining generation for our climate future. And there is real progress being made, but there are also, we're experiencing some real setbacks too. And right. Meanwhile, these fires continue to burn.
Right. Well, we're going to have to pause there, John. And I say pause instead of wrap up, because you're going to be in town to talk about your book. Yeah. And I believe it's July 29th. Correct me if I'm wrong. You're going to be talking about your book and wildfires, the science thereof, at the Park City Library. We'll, between now and then, Claire and I will be reminding people of that. So that's one of the One Book, One Community talks, and we appreciate that very much. Again, John Valiant, the name of the book is Fire Weather, A True Story from a Hotter World. John, thank you so much, and we'll see you in July.
Yeah, we hope to have you back.
I would love to come back, and I really look forward to maybe we'll get to meet in person at the library.
Absolutely.
Really looking forward to that gathering. And in the meantime, take care, and I wish you all clear skies.
Thank you very
Same
much,
to
John.
You. Same Thank to you. Thank you, John, for joining us.
All right.
For sure.